All right, welcome to week 10 of CompSci E52, or CS50. This is our final section. We'll be covering a cumulative review of the course subjects which we've addressed thus far this semester, with a particular emphasis on the things we've learned in the last few weeks. Just taking a look at the topics which we're going to be going over today, we'll be looking at different base number systems, including binary, octal, and hex, talking about bitwise operators, asymptotic runtime and notation, stacks and queues, some basic data structures, hashing, using a hash table and the hash functions that go with them, trees and tries, and then moving on to our web design topics, including HTML, CSS, PHP, SQL, and JavaScript, the document object model, and Ajax. And if there are any questions at the end about any other topics that aren't listed up here now, we'll make sure there's time available to discuss those as well. All right, jumping right into it. First, let's talk about base number systems. So here we have these four number systems which we've talked about, just different base representations of numbers. So binary is base 2, so it's just ones and zeros. You have two different digits, hence base 2, 1 and 0. On the right here, we're representing the number 42, this familiar value, using binary. So it's 101010. And the reason it takes this form is because, much like in decimal, each place represents that base raised to a certain power. For example, the decimal representation of 42 is just 4 and 2, 10 to the 0 times 2, plus 10 to the 1 times 4. So 40, 10 to the 1 times 4, plus 2, 10 to the 0, which is 1, times 2 to get 42. And if we look at the binary representation, which is 101010, this is 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2, 2 to the 3, 2 to the 4, and 2 to the 5, which gives us 2 to the 5 is 32 times 1, 2 to the 3 is 8 times 1, and 2 to the 1 times 1 gives us 2, 32 plus 8 plus 2 does in fact give us 42. If you want to go the other way and convert the actual value to this rather than interpreting one that's already in binary, think of it as taking the largest power of 2 and then filling in that one, and then thinking of how much of the number you have left. For example, now we have 32, so the next the remainder of the number is 10. So we look at the next largest power of 2, that's 16, that's too big. Then we have 8, we turn that bit on because we do have at least 8 more, and then we end up turning on this 2 as well. So we have 32 plus 8 plus 2 to represent 42 in binary. Hexadecimal, you can think along the same lines as you would think in binary, because each set of four binary digits does map, does correspond to a hexadecimal digit. For example, if I wrote E1 as a hexadecimal number, a hexadecimal number always starts with this 0x, just to note that we are working with a hexadecimal number. You recall that we have digits 0 through 15, where A through F represent the digits 10 through 15, since we obviously don't have numerical digits in our system of numbers to represent those values. So here we have a 1, so we have a nibble, a set of 4 bits, half a byte. So 1 is represented as 0, 0, 0, 1. And this E, well, what value is represented by E? So F is the largest, so F is 1110, yeah, which is 14, because F is 15 because it's the largest digit. E is 1 less than that, so it's 1111, or 1110, sorry. So if we wanted to represent E1 in hexadecimal, that's the same as representing 1110, which represents E, and 0001, which represents 1 in binary. So there's that simple relationship between the two. Any questions about these base number systems? Decimal everyone should be pretty familiar with, so I think we can skip over that. Okay. And octal is just base 8, if you've forgotten. Hexadecimal tends to be more important for our purposes, but do be familiar with octal as well. It works in the same way. Okay. Bitwise operators. So you recall, we have these different operators which we can use on two bit strings. So what is a bit string? Well, a bit string is just the low-level representation in ones and zeros of any value stored in the computer. So if we're writing code in C, we might have an int or a char, an int being on our 32-bit systems, a 4-byte value, a char being a 1-byte value. And these values are made up of ones and zeros. So some char having some value might look exactly like this, in fact, like some bit string 11100001. And using bitwise operators, we can manipulate this data at the level of the bit string. So normally we can only access data by the byte, any particular pointer points to a particular byte. And you'll notice we don't have any data types which are smaller than one byte. We can only access a char. And this introduces somewhat of a limitation in terms of how we're using memory, because suppose we want to keep track of a true-false value, a Boolean. Well, we could actually keep track of 8 of those if we had access to each individual bit within a byte, but because of how we address memory, it doesn't really work because we can only access that one value that's represented by that address pointing to the particular byte. But using bitwise operators, we can actually sort of play around and manipulate these bits one by one if we're clever about it. So how do we use these bitwise operators? Well, they sort of work like logical comparisons in a way. So AND, for example, works like a logical AND. So we handle these bitwise operations bit by bit, comparing these two bit strings alongside each other. So 1100 and 1010. Going by the bits left to right, what do we end up with? 1000. Yeah, because if two bits are both on, if they're both one, we can think of them as being both true. True and true is true. Anything else is false. So we end up with 1000. Okay, what about ORing these two bit strings together over here? Okay, so we end up with 1011. Because if either of those or both is true, then OR of the two is true. So it's like, is it raining or do I have an umbrella? If either one is true or if both is true, then the statement is true, so we get a 1 instead of a 0. What about XOR? This is a little different from OR. So what bit string do we end up with here?
Zero.
You guys can alternate if you like.
Zero.
It's always so odd hearing students rattle off bit strings, by the way. It's kind of like binary solo in Flight of the Conchords. Yeah. So, yeah, we do in fact get 0110. And then, yes?
Okay, quick question.
Yeah.
So, a character you can represent as an integer, but how do you tell if it's a character or an integer if it's in terms of bits?
So how do you tell if something is a character or an integer if it's represented at the bit level? Yeah.
You can't.
All right. So the answer is you can't. Well, if you look at the bits themselves, it's just ones and zeros. And if you think of how computers work at the most basic level, everything is just ones and zeros. And so with languages like C, we introduce abstractions where we have ways of knowing, okay, we're keeping track that what we have here, we're remembering that's called a char, and what we have here is called an int, and the computer sort of keeps track of how long those values are and what bit strings correspond to what type of data types and what it wants to grab at each place. If you think back to the ASCII table, you'll recall that each of these symbols which we see drawn on our keyboard like this that we're familiar with writing on paper actually map to a numerical value, and they are stored, in fact, as these bit strings. So the computer just happens to have a high level of way of interpreting these bits as characters that it can then represent on the screen. But this is just a result of layers upon layers of abstraction. And at the most basic level, it's all bit strings. It's ones and zeros all the way down, so to speak. Okay. Any questions about that? All right, so we'll take a look at this one last bitwise operator. This operator is a unary operator. So as opposed to these other ones, which take two arguments, this takes only one argument. So what does the not operator do?
Take the opposite of every digit.
Yeah, so you flip the bits is one way you could also put it. So you take the opposite of each bit. So if you have 1001, you get 0110. Or if you have 1010, you end up with 0101. There was a little confusion last year in lecture, I believe, because David had a tendency of saying that when you use the not operator, you flip the bits. And so people looked at what he was doing with his hand and thought you were reversing the bit string. Everyone was very confused. So this example is very poor because I am, in fact, reversing the bit string. But note that 1 always goes to 0, 0 goes to 1. You're flipping the bits much in the same way that you might flip some switch that you find on the wall, a light switch. I won't do that to save Chris the trouble of adjusting the iris on the camera. But yeah, so it's everything is either on or off, like a light switch. If you flip the bit, you flip the switch. You go to the opposite for every value in the bit string. All right. Any questions on bitwise operators? All right, so why do we care about these things? It's kind of a neat novel concept that we can manipulate bits. So it's because there's some useful applications of being able to do things like this. You recall we talked about the one-time pad. So it turns out that if you take some bit string that you want to keep secret and you want to send to someone in a hidden message using some cryptography, you can do something called the one-time pad, where you take some other bit string of the same length or shorter length and you just repeat it, and you XOR the two strings together. So I have this encryption key, which is distinct from my other key, and then I use an XOR operation on the two, and I end up with this encrypted key, and you can verify for yourself just by looking at that when the two above differ, it's 1, and when the two above are the same, it is a 0. So we have this encrypted string now. And it turns out, and if you think about it for a little while, you realize that this is in fact true, if you then encrypt that encrypted key with the same encryption key, you end up with the same string you started out with. So if you keep your encryption key secret, and you send someone this encrypted message, and they also know the encryption key, they can decrypt it with that same encryption key and get your message out. And the great thing about this is that if some adversary intercepts the encrypted message but has no idea what the encryption key is, they know absolutely nothing about what's contained within that message because it's just a bit string of some length. And without this additional piece of information, there's actually nothing they can derive from the patterns in the bits that would tell them anything about what's contained within your message. So it's sort of a perfect encryption method. The problem with this is then it necessitates that you have some way of secretly transmitting this other bit string, which sort of defeats the purpose of the exercise. But it is an interesting thing to think about and an example of an application of bitwise operators. Another perhaps more useful to what we're doing in the class is the example of a memory-efficient swap function. So this always looks a little scary when students look at it, I think. But if we look at it one more time, just while we're reviewing and think about how bitwise operators are working here and relating it back to that encryption example, I think you'll see it's really not all that confusing. And you can honestly just remember it by remembering star X, XOR star Y, then reverse it again, if that mnemonic helps you just to know how to do a bitwise swap like this. Yes?
Is there a space between int and swap, or is that like a void function?
Oh, there is a space there. Int is the return type. Oh, this should be a void function. You're right. Thank you for pointing out that error. So this is, in fact, a void function because it is not returning any values. It's just modifying the values that are passed in. Thank you very much for pointing that out. That was slightly misleading. Yeah, definitely. Okay, so you'll notice it's receiving these pointers that we're dereferencing them. So x is XORed with y, and we store in x the XOR of the two. So it's sort of x encrypted by y. And then we encrypt y with the encrypted value stored in x now, and then perform this operation once more. And we get the interesting result that x becomes 0101, y remains 1100, and then y becomes 1001, which you'll note is our previous x value. And then x, once it's XORed with y once again, becomes 1100, our previous y value, and y remains 1001. So without ever using a temporary variable, we were able to quite cleanly swap these two variables in place without ever having to introduce any more memory being used by the system. Everyone more or less comfy with this example? Okay, so let's move beyond bitwise operators now and talk about asymptotic runtime. So switching gears to this, so you recall asymptotic runtime, we use asymptotic notation to denote this. Asymptotic runtime is not concerned with the precise number of steps or the amount of time which it takes for an algorithm to run. It's more concerned with the rate at which the amount of time taken by the algorithm to run increases as the input size increases. So for example, if we have like n squared asymptotic runtime, then as your input increases along this axis, so like maybe a string of size 100 or 1,000 or 10,000, your runtime increases at a rate kind of like this. It's quadratic. And if it's linear, it might look something like this. Quadratic doesn't always necessarily have to be larger than linear, however, and for some values, linear could also look something like this if it's a higher constant. We don't concern ourselves with constants, if you recall, however, so we would still consider this to be asymptotically faster than this because you'll note that as we approach higher numbers, this will always outpace this. So n squared will always outpace n at some point, regardless of the constant, for very large values of n. So making this a little more concrete, once again, big O notation refers to the upper bound on the runtime, so the longest we ever really expect it to take. We would write big O of n squared for an algorithm which we expect to finish within n squared time. Omega is used to denote the lower bound on runtime, so it's in the best case. So if there's some special scenario we might encounter where we got lucky and we got input that's very easy to deal with. Perhaps we could run in linear time rather than quadratic time for some algorithms. What's an example of an algorithm which has that property, by the way? Yes?
With a search, like you have a linear search, and you get the first element, then you're done, or is that not quite right?
So the question was, what about a linear search where you just happen to get lucky the first time? In a way, you could think of it like that. I feel like I'd be a little hesitant to say it's constant time. I suppose there's a slightly better example we've looked at previously. That is good thinking, though. That's definitely relevant. All right, we'll come to it on another slide. Hopefully, it'll jostle your memory a little bit. Okay. And if a program if a program takes 6n squared plus 4n plus 57 steps to run for input of size n, say I did some really sophisticated math and I worked this out myself, I figured out that the processor actually handles exactly this many operations and all those operations take the same amount of time to execute, okay, because I thought about this for a really long time and I did some really sophisticated algebra and got a really low order polynomial. So what would I say, how fast does this run asymptotically? How do we get that from this? Yeah.
Is it n squared?
And what of n squared? Our asymptotic notation uses big O or omega? Yeah, so it runs in big O of n squared. So, but it's 6n squared though, right? So it'd be big O of 6n squared, right? Huh?
Wasn't it not concerned with
the
constant?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so we're not concerned with constants. So what we actually do is we take the highest order term, which is that 6n squared, and then we toss away all the constants. So this just runs asymptotically in big O of n squared. We just take the highest order term, this 6n squared, throw away the constants. We don't care about them because we might have a computer next year that runs six times faster. So what does that constant even mean? Nothing relevant to us asymptotically. So big O of n squared for that algorithm because we toss away the constants and just take the highest order term. Okay, so quiz time. Not quiz one. Much less important, less strenuous quiz. Bubble sort. What is the asymptotic runtime at the upper bound of bubble sort? Let's think about how bubble sort works. If you take a look at what bubble sort is doing, it's actually not all that hard to figure out. In the abstract, it might seem harder because it seems like a memorization problem where it's like, oh, I don't really remember what the equations were for that. But actually, think about it. So bubble sort, you have some list of n numbers. They're in some order. They're probably out of order. 3, 4, 1, 2. Okay, so the first time we go through, we look at 3 and 4, and 3 is less than 4, so we don't switch them. We get here, 4 is less than 1, so we switch them. 4 is less than 2, so we switch them. Okay, so we just iterated over this entire array one time. Okay, now we're going to have to go to the back, to the beginning. And we have to repeat this process until everything's in order. Okay, so we do up to n minus 1 swaps. And how many times might we have to do that? What's the maximum number of times? How many? You actually do even better than that. N minus 1 times. And that's because if 1 is all the way on the right and it has to go all the way to the left, that happens in n minus 1 iterations. It's correct and perhaps in most cases better to think of it as up to n times or bounded by n times because that's thinking more asymptotically so that you're actually on the right track. So we end up with n minus 1 times n minus 1, and I'm just being pedantic with using these very specific terms to further illustrate the point that we can just throw away some of these. This ends up being, I hope I don't embarrass myself, n squared minus 2n plus 1, and big O of n squared, because I don't care about these terms. That's just big O of n squared. Is bubble sort an omega of n squared, or can we do better? So in an naive implementation of bubble sort, we would still go through n minus 1 times because we said, well, I don't know, maybe it's not sorted yet. But can we check if it's sorted the first time we iterate through? Sure, we can do whatever we want. We're writing the program. So the first time we go through, we say, okay, say everything's already in order. We have 1, 2, 3, 4. And I keep track of, have I swapped? And this is some Boolean. It's initially false because we haven't swapped yet, right? So check these two, don't swap. Check these two, don't swap. Check these two, don't swap. Had I ever swapped, I would have set this to true. But I never swapped. So I checked, did I swap? And I realized I didn't swap, so I must already be sorted. So having iterated over this array only one time, so in linear time, I've completed the algorithm and I return. So if we implement it like this, the algorithm is implemented in omega of n. So in the worst case, following this procedure, it would still take up to n squared time. But since we can optimize for these special cases, we can say this algorithm is in omega of n time, because we can run asymptotically in linear time given certain circumstances. Is everyone happy with that distinction? All right, cool. Just refresh ourselves on a couple others. What about merge sort? This one's a little trickier than the other ones. And you can just say n log n, actually, because all the different logarithms are just actually separated by a constant by the nature of how logarithms work. But yeah, log base 2 n, to be precise, is actually exactly correct. So merge sort runs in big O of n log n. And if you think about the way merge sort works, where it has to iterate over all the contents of the array, and then it's able to do a number of steps on each equivalent to log n for each of them, you can see how we multiply those together to get n log n, which is very good for a sorting function. Then linear search, the hint is in the name. O of n, yeah, it runs in linear time. Yeah, so just a refresher on applying these to actual algorithms. Okay, so sort of a jarring transition. Are there any questions about asymptotic runtime or notation before we move on? Okay, just a good core concept to really have mastered. Okay, so let's talk about some basic data structures now. So a stack. So a stack is a first-in, last-out data structure. So that means the first thing you put on the stack is the last thing you're going to be taking out. So if you put anything on top of it afterward, you have to take that out before you're able to get to the things lower down or higher up, depending on the way you think of it. Since we're talking about putting things on the top of the stack, let's say it's lower. What's an example of a stack that we've been using frequently in this course? Yeah. Yeah, the function stack or the call stack. So this call stack that we've created, which contains each of these stack frames, which correspond to functions we're calling in our C programs. And if you forget what that looks like, I'll draw a picture. And it looks something like this. So we start up at the top of the stack, and we create a frame for main. And any variables we create within main end up in this stack frame. So if we have int x equals 7 here, which we declare within main. That goes there. Suppose then we call func1. So we end up with another frame for func1. We create some other variable x. This has a different scope because it's in a different stack frame. And you'll see here, as we're calling functions, we have at the top of our stack, lower in my picture because this is a convention we've been using, but at the top in the sense, and that's where we're placing things on. You'll see that's the most recently created function, and everything that's older is actually lower on the stack. So we have this sense of putting things on top and then removing them in reverse order. And this also relates back to the Inception demo all those weeks ago, where we talked about how in the movie they enter a dream, and then their dream within the dream, and then a dream within the dream within the dream. And then as they get the kicks back, they go back to the previous dream, and then the one before that, and then they end up in reality with the tops and stuff. So yeah. So the kick sends us back up one level and to the previous element on our stack. And this looks something like this. So if we push onto the stack, we place this element at the top of it. And then we can also pop things off of the stack. And we remove it in much the same way from the same end, the top of the stack. Another example I used for this was an alleyway I saw on Dunster Street. I remember using this example. It was a driveway. There were two buildings. And here was the street I was walking along, and I noticed that in this small alleyway, there were three vehicles. And it occurred to me that to store their automobiles, they were using a first-in, last-out data structure. And it occurred to me that that was really unfortunate, because if they ever wanted to drive this truck again, they were going to have to take both of these vehicles out. So stacks, good for some things, really bad for other things. perhaps a lesson in thinking about what data structure you use before implementing your program or implementing your real estate. All right, so any questions about stacks? All right, so we'll move ahead and talk about queues, which sort of look similar to stacks but behave a little differently. More flexible behavior in some ways. It's a first in, first out, not last out, first out, so a FIFO data structure, I guess. We have insert and remove operations as opposed to push and pop. So you can, when we say push and pop, actually the phrase was coined when stacks were first invented, actually at Radcliffe, right here at Harvard. The name of the woman who invented them escapes me at the moment, unfortunately. But it was based off of the cafeteria tray receptacles that they had at Radcliffe in the cafeterias, whereby you would push the trays onto the machine, and it was spring-loaded, so they'd get pushed down, and the thing that was supporting them and holding them up would go further down, and then you would take one off the top, and it would pop back up. So it's just a cute way to remember that. That also gives you a little bit of the history behind CS as it relates to this university. Okay, coming back to queues, insert and remove, these different operations which we have for queues, first in, first out. So we can insert something to the tail end of our queue. So it's like this guy's getting in line at this point. And then it's like he's at the deli counter, I guess. And then someone at the front, well, it's finally time for them to get their sliced ham or whatever. And now they're removed. And so now we have these guys still left in the queue. And the person who's been waiting the longest is next. So if you want to consider like fairness in your data structure, I guess, you want to handle requests that you received first, then you would want to implement a queue for that particular purpose. Okay, any questions about these data structures? All right, cool. So let's move on and talk about something a little more sophisticated, a tree. So a tree consists of branches. So you can think of each of these, what we might previously have called in the linked list as nodes, as being branch structures. And each of these branches points to another branch on the left and to the right. So it's sort of like an inverted tree, if you want to think about it like that. Because we have the root node here at the top, and it sort of branches up like a tree does, with the branches going to the left and also to the right. And in the center of that, you have some value that's at the crux of the branch, if you will. So a value can be stored at each of these, and then we store other values relative to them, either to the left of them or to the right of them. So if we have some knowledge beforehand of how these values are arranged in the tree, one can imagine how we could traverse the tree in such a way that we look through a smaller number of nodes than all of them and are able to determine whether or not that value is in the tree at all.
Yeah. Another
really? What is it?
The struct branch.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for pointing that out. All right. Branch is, in fact, spelled with an H. Today I learned. Okay, so all right, thank you again. So if we have some knowledge about how these are arranged in this tree, then it's helpful because then we can cut down the amount of time we spend looking for that value. So consider the binary search tree. So a binary search tree is a special tree. Not all trees are binary search trees, but some can be. So consider how the values are arranged here. What jumps out at you about the way these values are arranged? Yes.
They're in order.
Yeah, so they're in order in a certain way. So, and anything that's to the left and below some value is of lesser value, and anything that's to the right and below some value is greater than that. Pardon. So, a binary search tree is a tree that's such that the left subtree is of each node contains only lesser nodes. So you can think of this branch that's branched off of from the root node as being a subtree that's contained on the left. It only has one branch, but it's still a tree. It satisfies the definition of a tree. On the right, that is more obviously a tree in the way we're used to thinking of it so far. And all values in the left subtree contain lesser nodes than the one at the root. And the right subtree of each node contains only greater nodes. And finally, the left and right subtrees of each node are also binary search trees, which is just an added constraint that tells us that not only is everything less than 8 to the left of 8 and everything to the right of 8 greater than 8, but everything to the right of 16 is greater than 16 and everything to the left of 16 is less than 16. So this pattern goes all the way down. So the entire binary search tree structure is arranged like this. And this is useful to us because if we want to know if 14 is in this tree, well, then we start at 8, we go to the right, We see 16, we go to the left. We see 15, we try to go to the left, but we can't. And we know that 14 is not here by looking at only three of the six values. All right, so how much faster is this asymptotically? Let's hold that question for a moment, because actually this binary search tree isn't optimal, because you'll notice that it seems like this path is longer than it needs to be. If we'd arranged this in a different way, we could have this a little higher up, and this would only be three deep. And it turns out the lower bound on the depth of the tree, if you choose the correct pivot point, as it were, is actually log n, or rather log n rounded up. So you'll see here that we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different nodes, and log n of 6 rounded up is actually 3. So this is only a maximum of 3 deep. So we can go through only a maximum of 3 values and determine whether or not any given value is in the tree. So how would we describe the asymptotic runtime of that lookup?
Log n?
Yeah. So it's big O log of n, because the upper bound on the number of comparisons we're going to make as we traverse through this binary search tree is log n. Yes? It'd be log n. If you think about it, so instead of dividing the problem in two at each step, giving you log base 2 of n, if you divided the problem into three possible distinctions, what do you think log base would be?
It would be base 3.
Yeah, it'd be log base 3. And just from mathematics, we know that any two log bases just differ by a constant value. So it's still in log n. You can just say log n time. You don't actually have to worry about the base. If you want to be precise when you're discussing the algorithm, you can certainly introduce that base. But it's also sufficient when we're talking about asymptotic runtime just to specify log of n. Yeah, definitely an insightful point pointing out how it differs with different branches. Yeah. And we'll be able to relate that to tries as well later on, because if you think about it, a try is just a particular implementation with some added functionality and representation of an n array tree. Any other questions about binary search trees or trees in general? Okay, cool. So now let's talk about hash tables. You might remember this from your implementation of problem set 6, Speller. So what is a hash table? Simply put, it's just an array which happens to have a hash function which is associated with it. So the hash function is responsible for mapping any input which is given to be stored in your hash table to some index in the associated array. And when I say associated array, I just mean the array we're using for the hash table. I don't mean an actual associative array, which we introduced later in PHP and JavaScript. So please don't get those two things confused. It's just we're dealing with some array and some hash function, just regular arrays and functions. So a hash table is important because it allows users to check whether something is contained in a data structure without checking throughout the entire data structure, much in the way that that binary search tree allowed us to cut down that lookup time by a bit. The example I used before, and I'm going to use it again, is suppose I'm in some factory where we're manufacturing these different cubes, I guess, of different colors, red, green, and blue, and I'm keeping track of all these cubes which we've produced. I take the blue cubes, I put them in the bin for blue cubes. I take the green ones, put them in the bin for the green ones, and the red ones, and put them in a bin for the red ones. So I have some function in my head where I take as input this cube I'm getting and then decide where to put it. And I'm deciding that based on its color. So it's a very simple hash function in this case. So if we create 65,000 cubes, 11,000 of them are blue, 23,000 of them are green, and 31,000 of them, I hope, are red. And then I want to look up where a particular green cube is because someone dropped their own green cube on the conveyor belt, and now, of course, they want it back, and somehow this is my problem. I need to look through these bins and figure out where it is. So instead of looking through 65,000 bins, I'd like to look through 11,000, I think I said, in the green bin. So I'm cutting down the amount of actual pieces I have to look through by quite a large figure. So it simplifies things for me quite significantly. And this ends up with lookup times, which are, in the raw sense, faster, practically faster. Not necessarily asymptotically faster, but in the real world, actually faster. Okay, any questions about hash functions or hash tables, what they look like, how they're implemented? So focusing in on hash functions themselves, a good hash function is deterministic, and it should also be well distributed. So what do I mean by deterministic? I mean exactly that, deterministic. So given some input, it maps it to some output, always. So if I take in the string like ABBA, and then I output it to 7, the next time I see ABBA, I certainly better output it to 7. Because if I output it to 9, because I'm using a random number generator, because I think that's going to give me like a nice distribution, because I took a statistics course once and that seemed like a good idea. No, you can't do that. You always need to have a guarantee that if I put a green cube in the green box, that when I look in that green box, that's where I would have put that cube. So it needs to be deterministic. Determinism isn't all I'm looking for, though. I also want to make sure this is well distributed. So I have about an equal chance of putting some random input into any particular space on my table. So I don't want them to be clumped. I want them to be distributed throughout. So if I have maybe 23,000 elements in my hash table, I'd like there to be like fairly equal probability that they're going to be in any particular element. So let's take a look at a bad example we used before, which sort of takes a bad idea to the extreme. We use XKCD hash, which given a word returns 4. So is this a valid hash function? Yeah, it's deterministic. It's well distributed for some definitions of well, not good definitions. So it returns 4. So if we think of an actual distribution of this, suppose our hash table is a very small one and it only has 10 entries, 0 through 9. So it's all actually right here. So this is about as badly distributed as it can possibly get because it's all clumped in the middle. We want something that looks a little more like this, sort of a uniform distribution, because then we're minimizing the average time we have to spend at each element looking for it. If you think if each one points to a linked list, for example, or some other structure like a binary search tree even, we want to minimize the number of elements that are in it such that when we go to look up there, we're actually saving time. Because if we put everything in one element, we might as well not have a hash table at all because it doesn't save us anything. Is everyone comfortable with why that is and satisfied with the explanation? Questions? Okay. Yeah. Oh, and just to emphasize the point, this is actually bad, so don't do it. All right, so moving on to the alternative data structure that some people ventured to try out. Pun not intended in a really big way. I'm going to emphasize that. Tries. So a try is, you can think of it as a tree of arrays. So it says fast lookup time, but also high memory use. If you recall looking at the big board, you'll see some people were really fast in terms of check, but they used like 117 megabytes worth of memory, and you were using maybe like, okay, this guy tried it out. And you were using like 76 kilobytes or something like that. Well, the reason for that is because they decided to use tries because they decided that they were going to prioritize fast lookup time over memory efficiency. So when you use try, you use a structure that looks something like this. So you have an array of pointers to different try nodes. So we talked about an N-ary search tree that would, rather than a binary search tree, just pointing to two things, one that could point to multiple things. So a try is sort of a realization of that idea, generalized to any value N. So if we're working with words in the alphabet, it might be reasonable to use a value like 26, or if we're including apostrophes, 27 as our N value. Or if we want to think about it in a different way, we could certainly represent that using any number that seems intuitive. Yes?
The sad part is that in theory, it's faster than a hash table because you only need to look through the words, the letters once because you're just going through.
Right.
But in practice, it's slower because the thing uses so much space, it doesn't fit into the processor's cache.
Right. So the point is that the size of the implementation...
turns out memory usage.
Right. So the point brought up was that using so much memory actually does incur a speed cost as well, because loading so much information into memory affects how much of that information is stored close to the processor. This is really low-level stuff that you'd learn if you took a class like CS61 here, which covers things like this. We won't go too in-depth into that, but just know that as you use larger and larger amounts of memories, you may also incur speed costs as well as a result of the computer having to micromanage all that memory being stored in different places because of hardware limitations. All right. Returning to tries, so in addition to all these pointers, you recall that in our binary search tree, we're also storing a value. So the sort of value we're storing in our tries is just a Boolean. I called it checkbox here because it's just like as we're marking off something on each of these try structures. Does anyone remember what that checkbox represents?
It's the end of the...
Yeah. So each try node can be thought of as corresponding to some prefix of a word that's located in your language. And if that prefix also happens to be a word, then we mark off this checkbox to say, we're not just on our way to some word, this is actually a word in its own right. So for example, if you had the if you have the word rabbit in your dictionary, then you go through a struct node for R-A-B-B-I-T, and then that last struct node has the checkbox checked, it's set to true, because you have the word rabbit. But if you go back one, you have rabbi. So do you have rabbi in your dictionary? I don't know, maybe you do, maybe you don't. And that can be checked to indicate whether or not that word's there. So you'll note that we actually don't incur any additional cost to store the word rabbi if we have the word rabbit already in our dictionary. We just have to set a value to true as opposed to false to indicate that we do in fact have that there. So there's a lot of benefits to storing languages in this way if you have a lot of words which have other words as prefixes to them. So what does this look like? So suppose we have this try here. This is sort of an abstract representation. We'll look at more of an implementation level one on the next slide, but perhaps a different type of illustration will help you understand better. Suppose we have the words to, t, 10, and in, and perhaps in as well, stored in this try. So we have a root try, which doesn't correspond to any actual prefix. You can think of it as representing the empty string, which we start out with. And then here we have, along this t pointer, we get this try that represents the word, the prefix t. And over here, the prefix I. I could perhaps be checked because I is a word in English. And we could actually store the word T as well, even though it's not really a word in English, if we wanted to store that word. But let's assume that's checked false because it's not a word we know. And then following this I pointer, we get to this struct which corresponds to 2. This corresponds to TE, which then branches off to TEA and TEN, which both share TE as a prefix. So you can sort of see how we have each of these words relating to each other within the structure. And although these words themselves are not ever stored, we don't store the actual strings in the tries. That's an important point to know. We don't store the actual strings, the sequence of characters, within the tries. We just have these structs that correspond to them. And the reason we can say the structs correspond to them is because each of these structs which corresponds to them is such that the only way that you can access that struct is by traversing a path such that that path is described by that string. So for example, we see here we have just a language that has the symbols A and B. So we're just taking a very small alphabet here for simplicity. If we're looking for the string A, we start at our root, so that empty string, and then we add an A. So we follow the A pointer, and the only way we could have ever gotten to this struct is if we just followed one A pointer. That's the only way we can get here. So we can assume this corresponds to that string A, that prefix. And since this is true, we know we have the word A in our dictionary. This dictionary contains A and BB, by the way. And over here, if we follow B, we note that B is not contained within the dictionary, but if we keep going down, BB is. So B is not here, even though that struct corresponding to the prefix is there, but that's just there to facilitate our getting to BB. So there's this unique path we can follow, and that allows us to assume that this struct corresponds to that string. And there is, in fact, a one-to-one correspondence in the data structure as a whole. Is everyone happy with sort of the thought behind tries and how they're representing the data? It's definitely a different way of thinking about representing information, but it is valid. Okay. Let's move on and start talking about some web design stuff. Put the memories of data structures behind us for now and talk about web languages, which perhaps some of you think are a little more fun. Okay, so HTML, Hypertext Markup Language, is what it stands for. And HTML just allows us to arrange and format our web page content on the page. So if you use something like Microsoft Word where you're formatting text, you have all these buttons for bold, italics, underline, strike through, that lets you format your text. In HTML, you're just passing a text file to a web browser from a server, and that's all it has access to. It has a text file, a .html file, which is really just a text file that contains HTML, and that's all the browser has to work with. So we need some way of marking this up such that we're able to represent boldface, font, etc., different formatting and arrangements of text using just this text. And to do that, we have a markup language, HTML, the standard way, eyes way of representing hypertext. So text that does stuff that's cool, like contain hyperlinks or contain images or movies or whatever. HTML is such that it's composed of tags, which are contained within angle brackets, which enclose regions of the page. Each beginning tag has an ending tag, and we close the most recently opened one first. So you'll remember that the entire page is enclosed in an HTML tag, and then we have body tags, and above those, head tags, which contain within them title tags, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we have all these nested tags. So you can think of the way you nest curly braces in your C code in the same way you nest these tags. So a beginning and ending tag enclose a certain region of the page, and they can in turn be enclosed by a larger group of tags. And tags may also have attributes. You can have attributes like style, for example, if you want to include CSS, or event handlers for JavaScript like onClick or onload or onSubmit, which we'll talk about later. And these are just written after the name of the tag, and you can use an assignment, an equal sign, to set them equal to some string, which gives, it's sort of like passing a parameter to that tag and modifying that part of the page in some way. Any questions about HTML at the basic level? So what does HTML allow us to do? It allows us essentially just to create these static web pages that exist as they are, and that's pretty much what you see is what you get. What you get in the text file is what you have on the web page. So, well, that's not all that interesting, but we can make it pretty, so that's cool, right? So we can use CSS, which is cascading style sheets, in order to sort of dress up the page. So you'll recall that using the style attribute in tags, you can make CSS declarations, which format the contents of a page in a particular way. And specifically, this is used to format the appearance of elements within a web page. So you can specifically say, okay, I want everything in the body tag to look like this. Or I want everything of class special to look like this. And you can specify a class as an attribute of a tag. So it allows you to sort of group different tags in different ways. So you're formatting different ones using different declarations in CSS. And you can do it this way using the style attribute, or you can also include in a separate .css file, which is linked in the head, the information separately. Yeah.
If you use the style attribute in HTML, is that considered using CSS?
Yes. Okay. So the question was, if you use the style attribute in HTML and include your CSS declarations there, does that count as using CSS, or do you have to use the external file? That counts as using CSS. When we say we want you to format your web pages using CSS, we mean we want you to use CSS declarations, and you have the option of doing that in place in the web page, or if you have a lot of different things you're doing and you don't want to have to write them everywhere and worry about updating them in all those different places, you include them in a separate CSS file, which is often very helpful if you make a larger web page with a lot of formatting. Style attributes allow for formatting of tag contents using CSS, actually, following up on that question. Examples, you might write things like align colon center, font size colon small, color colon blue, and display colon block. And just bringing back a previous example, actually, to see how dramatically this can alter the appearance of a web page. I won't bring up both for comparison, but if we look at the current state of blinky texts, you'll see that using CSS, this is normally a pretty straight-laced looking website, if you don't remember from the initial demo, but by changing just CSS information, what was previously a plain form with a white background, a boring image, and forms that were not previously hot pink, I assure you, into something that is an altogether different animal. And the way we did this is just by including a different CSS style sheet at certain times of the day using PHP, which specifies the color information for different regions of the page. So just by changing a few lines of code without actually, or a few lines of markup using CSS, without changing anything about the overall structure or design of the page, we're able to make a radical change to the appearance just using CSS statements. So it's a very powerful way of facilitating our formatting of our web pages. Okay. Any questions about how CSS is used? All right, cool. Oh, and in formatting our external .css files, you write it something like this. The format is use a selector, which is the name of the tag. So if I want to do something to the body or all of my H2 tags or something like that, I would include in curly braces a series of declarations. These are declarations, by the way. Ending them with semicolons, as we often do with statements when we're writing things in this class. And this would have by linking this into the page, it would have the effect of changing all of those selector tags. So all those tags with that name that we use selector in place of here This is not stating that we write selector and then in parentheses name of tag, by the way, just to be absolutely clear. What I'm saying is when I say selector, I mean the name of the tag. I just realized that could be ambiguous, so I want to really drive that home. So you would actually write something like body, and then following that, you would use curly braces. Is that clear? Yes? The parentheses, this is a bad call on my part. These parentheses shouldn't exist. Looks like that. Just to be absolutely crystal clear, you write something like this. I apologize if I presented that in a less than optimal way, which I clearly did. Any question? Yeah?
But can selectors be more complicated than that?
Yeah.
Large groups of tags?
Sure. So you can specify all tags having a particular class by specifying a class attribute. And if you set a bunch of tags to have some class special, then you can write something like .special. And that would apply to all special fields rather than selectors. So it would look for all tags with special as their class and then apply that formatting to them. And if you wanted to get even fancier and look for just H2 tags that happen to be special or tables that happen to be special, you can get more specific by using both. So yeah. Any more questions about how to use CSS? Okay, cool. So we'll move on to talking about PHP. So PHP stands for PHP Hypertext Preprocessor, and the PHP in that stands for PHP Hypertext Preprocessor. Bring us back to the idea of recursion from earlier in the course. It's a recursive acronym, much like GNU. GNU is not Unix, so it's cute. So what is PHP? So PHP is a language which preprocesses hypertext. When a PHP file that you've created is accessed, so the user says, oh, I want to go to index.php, what happens is that the server runs the PHP file through a PHP interpreter and then provides the output to the user. So when you see some PHP file in your web browser, you're not actually seeing the original PHP file, you're seeing its output, because the PHP file contains sort of a program that's being run through a PHP interpreter, which then essentially builds a web page or a text file, which might be a web page, out of that and then gives it to you. So you never actually get to see any of the code, including a PHP file, which would be enclosed in these question mark tags, because the PHP interpreter runs through that, strips it all away, and then just gives you what's left when it's finished. So if you want to write any code that dynamically generates a web page containing some particular customizable content, but you don't want the user to see the code that went into this, you should use PHP. So for example, if you're making a connection to your database and you are including your database password, you want to use PHP as opposed to JavaScript so no one can see it. Questions about any of this basic stuff about PHP before we get more in depth? Yes.
There was a question on more of a practice test where it gave you some code in HTML and you had to give the PHP that would have generated that. How do you sort of approach that?
So the question is, how would you convert HTML that you're looking at into PHP code that might generate that HTML? This is apparently a previous year's quiz question. So assuming you had information about where you could access the data that's shown on the page, I mean, suppose you looked at, from PSET 7, someone's portfolio page. So you see some table that contains all these data entries. So if you know that this information was stored in a MySQL database, for example, you could sort of think about how you construct that. And this is essentially what you did for the problem set because you knew what it had to look like. So you would just work backward and say, okay, I need this information in this format, so I need to think about how procedurally I can build it. And so if I'm a person and I'm drawing that web page, what I would do is say, okay, get some information, draw a row on the table. Get some more information, draw another row on the table. And a computer does the same thing, just way faster and more efficiently than we could possibly do it, and in binary. You would think, okay, so I'd want to use some for loop in PHP, which is going to iterate through some resource I got from this database, which contains this, gets an array from each, and then outputs that information into a row on the table. So you essentially just want to think how procedurally you would go about generating that content, and then translate that algorithm, because that's basically what it is, into the PHP code which would construct that output. Is that a satisfying answer? Okay, great. Good question. Okay. Talking about the nature of PHP as a language, comparing it back to C. Once again, C is a compiled language, which means that The C source code is first reduced to assembly code, something that the computer can actually understand. The processor can look at assembly code and say, oh, I know that instruction does. I'm going to run that through the processor now. PHP remains at the level of source code until it's interpreted by the interpreter. So we don't first compile it before we run it. We just run our text file with our source code right through the interpreter, let it take care of it. So at runtime, it's interpreted rather than first compiled and then run. C is a strongly typed language, which means we actually care what the data types are in each variable. If we create an integer x that stores the value 7, we can't put a string in it later. In PHP, we don't really care. We kind of play it fast and loose with our data types. If we store in $x 7.3, we can store the letter A in it later. It doesn't really matter. We can just store any value in any variable. And this is useful because it gives us some flexibility in how we're using our variables, but it's also potentially dangerous because it gives you an extra thing to keep track of in terms of how you're using your variables. So use with caution. Any questions about these two distinctions between C and PHP and what it means about them as a language and how we use them? Okay, so let's move ahead and talk about MySQL. So SQL is a structured query language. So it's a way of interacting with a MySQL database, a SQL database. And database software allows us to store information in rows. So data is stored as entries, which contain a set of finite fields, which contain values. So a database is all of our information. And we arrange this in tables, which are contained within the database. And then each entry is a particular row in that table of information. And each of those rows contain individual fields. So the rows are sort of like structs, which contain a bunch of different fields, a bunch of different data that's connected. And a field is just something within that. So a certain property of each of those objects that's contained within this table, which contains a bunch of them. And a database, which keeps track of those tables. I think I asked this in another section, and no one knew what I was talking about, but is anyone familiar with the Colbert Report? So in the early days of the program, they had a running joke where they had the on-notice board. And Stephen had this big list. It was this chart into which he could slide these rows that contained the list of something that was on notice, which essentially meant that it was like at risk of being dead to him. And he had another board for that, actually, the dead to me board. And anytime someone did something that displeased them, they went on notice. So that could sort of be thought of as a database table. So Stephen takes a row, and he fills in the field, which is the name of the thing that's on notice, and then he inserts it into the table, which is called on notice. And if he wants to move something to the dead to me list, then presumably it has to come off notice, because how can something be on notice if it's dead to you? So he would delete it from the on notice table and then insert into the dead to me table. Yes? Oh. Okay, so a lot to internalize, perhaps. Is everyone happy with sort of the explanation of the structure of databases and how they, the different components of them relate? Okay, so how exactly is Stephen executing these operations when he's working on these tables? Well, we have these four operations available to us that we've talked about using. We have insert, so we use insert to insert a new entry. So think back to something a little more familiar. So we recall talking about a table of students where we wanted to insert some new student named Robert into our class. So our table of students kept track of each of those different students we're getting in the class. Each row has only one field. We're only keeping track of the names of the students because we're just not that organized, I guess. We just want to know the names of all the students in our class. So how would we insert a student into our database, assuming the table is called students?
Like MySQL
query. Yeah. Oh, don't worry about that. Just give me the SQL query, actually. You don't have to give me the PHP functions. That's okay. Yeah, so it would actually be insert into students value, and then in parentheses and single quotes, Robert, and then end with not actually a semicolon if you're using it through PHP, but that's fine. Okay, delete, so what if Robert drops out? He's not a very good student, so we need to delete him from the database. So how do we do that? Yeah.
Delete from students where they become Robert.
Yeah, so delete from students, so delete from the table students, where, so specifying what rows we're talking about, where name equals Robert. So if a row in the database students satisfies the condition name is equal to Robert, we delete them. Delete from students where name equals Robert. gets rid of Robert from the database, and anyone else named Robert also, incidentally. Mm-hmm. So we have multiple Roberts. We probably want to keep track of an ID for each student, so we can only kick one Robert out of the class, because why should every Robert suffer from the actions of this one delinquent Robert? That's not fair. That's not the America I grew up in. So suppose now we want to select a particular, individual from a database. So we want to. So Robert came back to school. He's back in school. That's good. He can grow up to be something. So we want to select him from the table now, because we do need to have a talk with him about his grades, because he's not doing that well. So we want to select one or more entries from the table. How would we select Robert if we assume he's in some database?
So it's like his ID would be select ID from students where name equals Robert.
Yeah, so if we want to get Robert's ID, if we're assuming we also have an ID field in our rows, we could also just select name as well, although that'd be a little silly because we're selecting his name where we're giving his name. So let's assume we do have an ID, just so it's a sane example, I guess. So select ID. So select the fields you want to get from the row, what you actually expect to get back. You can use a star to say all to get all the fields, by the way. So select then the names of the fields you want, separated by commas, from students, so from that table students, where, and then specify the constraints you expect the rows to satisfy. So where name equals Robert, for example, here. And that would give us back all the rows or all the students in the table students which satisfy the constraint that name equals Robert. So in this case, assuming we just have the one Robert in class, we get back the one row containing Robert. Okay, so finally we might want to change something in the table. So we don't necessarily want to remove a row or add a new one, but we just want to make a change to an existing row. So some student, we want to update the fields. Maybe Robert likes to go by Bobby, so we're going to accommodate Robert. So, or Bobby, sorry Bobby. So we're going to update the fields of an existing entry. So we know we have one person named Robert, not Bobber. So we have one person, we'll edit that out later, right? Of course. So we want to find our student named Robert in the database. And if we have more than one, we can also have a user ID, which we're checking as well. So we can check multiple constraints to make sure we get the Robert we want. So how would we go about, assume we have one Robert, how would we update Robert such that his name is now Bobby? Yeah.
Update student set name equals Bobby where ID equals the right ID.
Yeah. So update student set name equals Bobby where name equals Robert and UID equals whatever Robert's ID is. Or if we know we just have one Robert, where name equals Robert, I suppose would be sufficient. And I believe you can set the where parameter and the set parameter in either order. Each one works. You do just need to specify the constraint using where and what you're changing using set. So then you write set and then specify what field is being changed specifically. So using a query like that, if we send it in using PHP, we're able to update our MySQL database such that where once we had Robert, we now have Bobby. Okay, and Bobby can, yes?
So with that, you can use like more than one constraint and use and?
We can use what?
Oh,
yes.
Name equals NID. Could you use or?
Yeah, you can use. The question was, can you make your condition a little more complicated in the way we've been able to modify Boolean conditions in C? For example, in C, you can write if A or B and C, something complicated like that. Can you do that in an SQL query? Yeah, you can. You can get as complicated as you want. You can use both and or to make these logical Boolean statements that can either be true or false. Yeah. Okay. So, for example, you want only Roberts who have the UID 3. So where name equals Robert and UID equals 3, then we get the Bobby we're looking for. All right. And Bobby causes trouble in other ways other than just his delinquency in class. You need to remember to escape your user input when it's inserted into a query string. So if you're formatting a query string like this and you're concatenating something provided by the user, don't trust your user to give you something that's actually going to work. Why would you trust the user? You can never trust the user. They're just some guy on the internet. Why are you listening to them? Don't. So if you're concatenating something in and then feeding it into your SQL database, you want to make sure that you sanitize that. And what that means is you run it through the MySQL real escape string function, and that gets rid of any anything that might be troubling. And here's an example of something troubling. You recall this example, this XKCD comic. Just run through it one more time. This woman gets a call about her son and causing computer trouble at school. Did he break anything? Well, he kind of broke something. Not directly, but indirectly. Did you really name your son Robert, some symbols, drop table student, semicolon? Yeah, little Bobby Tables. Sure, what's wrong with that? Well, we lost this year's student records. I hope you're happy. And she hopes they've learned to sanitize your data inputs. I hope you've learned to sanitize your data inputs and that is something you've done previously. And if you haven't done it on PSET 7, then you make sure you do it in any implementations of SQL databases on future websites you run. Because this is how people get hacked. And this is why we learn things like this. Because there are real-world implementations of SQL, not just these academic ones we're doing with CS50 Finance, where if you expose yourself to an SQL injection attack in even one place, you compromise the integrity of your database and allow someone to run these arbitrary commands on your database, and you lose security and you don't necessarily get to retain your information. And these are things that happen. A similar exploit, the buffer overrun exploit, is a common hack which is used to access lower levels of software and run arbitrary code on different devices. You may recall we talked about in lecture how a hack in Legend of Zelda by naming Opponent of the Horse some particular string. They were able to change contents on the stack by reaching beyond the region of memory and changing things there so that it was actually arbitrary code that was then run by the Wii to allow them to install third-party applications on the system. So this is serious business, honestly. Like, it really is. So this is something to definitely take note of. And if you walk away from this course not learning anything other than anything high level other than this, make sure you take that with you. Because if you work in developing applications of the future, this is important. Okay. So thinking of web design at a high level, sort of in terms of development of interactivity, so we think of the different steps we've gone through in refining our knowledge of web design. HTML, it allows us to create static web pages, so the most sophisticated thing we can really do here is a form that submits information to another page. It's kind of cool, I guess, but not that cool. It's pretty static. The page doesn't change. We can't construct the page in a certain way to incorporate other information to make it different. PHP, we dynamically generate a web page, so when we're first putting it together using a PHP interpreter, we can pull information in from a database and sort of customize what we see on the screen. But after it's loaded, well, that's pretty much it. JavaScript allows us to create web pages with dynamic content. So JavaScript allows us to create a page such that after you load it, it can do things because JavaScript is executed on the client side. So that means that after you load the page, the user can continue to do things with it that change the contents of the page. And if we think back to this other example, which I used to demonstrate the flexibility of JavaScript allow you to change the user experience, we see we're able to implement a Pokemon battle on the page. So we have different contents of the page, which change over time as the result of functions being executed by the browser in JavaScript code that is included in the HTML file. You'll see that there is, in fact, source code here, which is being executed on my computer right now, having been retrieved from the server. So now this is happening independent of any web server in my browser. And if I click on this button, FirePunch, another JavaScript function is called. Charizard uses FirePunch, knocks out Alakazam in one hit because he's level 42. What is that? It's super effective. The wild Pokemon is defeated, and I've won the battle, and the music even changes. So I'm able to completely change the user experience on this web page dynamically after the page is loaded because I'm using JavaScript, which is interpreted by my browser. Okay, so let's go back and actually consider that a little more slowly rather than I understand everyone's probably just very excited about the Pokemon battle, so maybe we missed some things there. So JavaScript, it's a programming language which we use with web design. Unlike PHP, JavaScript is executed client-side. Client-side, what's that mean? This side, on the client machine, on my laptop, not on some server sitting in some dark room in the Science Center basement or Amazon headquarters or whatever. It's right here. It's all happening on my processor. JavaScript code is included in the HTML and it's passed to the browser. So PHP runs the code, gives you the output. JavaScript, we give you the code, you deal with it. Your browser will figure it out itself. Like CSS, JavaScript is included either in the HTML page or linked in from an external .js file. So you can just include a script tag in the head of the page that allows you to say, oh, I have a bunch of JavaScript functions I want to use, but I have them in this page, and they're just dynamically linked in. It's analogous to using a header file in C, or I believe require once in PHP to bring in information from another file. It just allows us to sort of outsource this code, which we might be using in multiple web pages, to another file for simplicity and neatness. And to avoid redundancy, we're using code, much like we would with a library. Linking in just looks like this. It's very simple. Script gets an attribute source equals the file where that JavaScript code is contained, and script, and this is just contained in the head. Really easy to do. You can include the actual JavaScript on the page as well, But if you want to reuse that code or make your page a little cleaner so you don't actually see this in the source, you can do this as well. It's a matter of preference, and in some situations, it's a better decision than others. And just looking at the languages we've learned in terms of which are useful with web design and comparing and contrasting them, both are interpreted languages. So we take the source and then we interpret it. We never compile it down to anything else. They're both loosely typed languages. So again, we don't worry about data types. We just do things, essentially. PHP is executed on the server side. The end user never sees the code. JavaScript is executed client side. The user necessarily sees all of the code. If you're doing something secure, don't do it in JavaScript because your user will see the code. That would be bad. Yes?
Well, you want to keep secure from the user.
So if I use secure loosely. So if you're doing something that you don't want the user to be able to see in your code, for example, you have some code which contains maybe like a plain text string, which is a password for a database or something, you wouldn't want that to be included in the JavaScript. I just mean to drive home the point that the user can see your code in JavaScript, which is not true in PHP. You can still establish secure connections with other servers using JavaScript, but if you want to hide something from the user on their computer, the code you're using you want to maintain proprietary or something like that, this does not offer that, because the user can necessarily, as I displayed by opening up the page source, see all the code that's running on their computer. Questions about the differences in these two languages? Okay. So the document object model. We didn't talk about this quite as much in lectures, so you might be unfamiliar with that particular description of this, but you definitely have been using it. Anytime you write something like document.getElementsById and specify an ID, and then specify some attribute of that element, for example, .value, then you are actually specifying something that's contained within the document object model. And you can intuit that by thinking, okay, I'm running document dot, so it's like a field contained within a document, and document is the document object. So this is a model which represents how that works. And then you're calling a method of that object, get elements by ID. So you're like getting these elements with a certain ID that are contained within this object. And then you add another dot and specify an attribute. So it's like, okay, so that's a field of this object that is an element. So I'm able to access within this document object different elements on the page and get specific attributes for each of those elements. So the document object is just a data structure that is used by the browser to keep track of all the information on a web page. And that's why the modern sophisticated browsers are able to access each individual element of a web page after it's been loaded and change them dynamically. So we can access individual elements by ID using JavaScript and the document object model, get their contents, and even change their contents. And you saw that in the Pokemon example, although we didn't walk through the code again, because I was taking that region of the page that was a cell in a table, and all of a sudden I'm putting a picture of an Alakazam in it. And that wasn't there previously, so I'm modifying the contents of that page such that we get a different result on the screen in real time. So an example of this is just if I have some variable name in JavaScript, and I want to set it equal to the value in some ID name on the page, document.getElementById name.value. And we get that value and we store it in this variable, and then we can do whatever we want with it. And this works the other way as well. I can get this element by ID, get the value field, and then set it equal to some other string. So just by switching these, I can treat this as a variable and change the contents of the page right at runtime. Questions about the document object model? Okay, moving right along. So once again, this slide, we're talking about the development of interactivity, as I'm calling it, in terms of web design. So we have JavaScript, so we can have web pages with a dynamic content, but that's still restricted in a way because it's restricted to the content that's available on this page. And there's a lot of other web pages that I could access as well, and maybe I want to get other content from other pages I've created and have on my server. There's information I'd like to make use of in some other PHP file I have, but I can't because it's in a different file. Well, that's where we have this technique called AJAX. AJAX is not a separate language. I don't mean to imply that. AJAX is a technique which applies JavaScript to get information dynamically from other pages and then rope that into what we're doing in another page. Asynchronous JavaScript and XML. So what this does is, we're excited about this. It is exciting. This is one of the most fun things I think we cover in web design. It's a really cool tool. It allows us to send requests to other pages for new content without ever reloading the page. So what's this look like? Well, it looks something like this. So if I pull open cloud.cs50.net, ajax2.php, I have some stupid page here where I type in two operands, 5 and 6. I have another field here labeled product. So I do the math, and presumably it's going to fill in this product with the number 30. Plays a stupid little animation for just half a second. And then after the request is finished loading, we place 30 within that product field. And if we were to look at the source here, which we'll not do right now just for lack of time, we would see that the JavaScript, which we might suspect is just multiplying it for us and then changing that field, is not actually performing any multiplication operations. What it's doing instead is sending this information to some other page on the internet, some other page that we're hosting, and requesting that it do that work for us and then send us back a response. So we're essentially outsourcing this multiplication operation to another page dynamically and getting information from another page on the internet asynchronously at the same time that we're still doing things on our own page and without reloading the page to get this new content. So essentially we're able to just pull in this other information and continue to do what we're doing with the JavaScript interpreter without changing focus to a different web page and without interrupting what the JavaScript interpreter is doing and allow us to pull in additional content without relying on having that available on the page we're currently on. Any questions about how Ajax works? If you look at the slides from the review session from last night, I had a more in-depth example where I showed the actual code for an Ajax call. For lack of time, I'm not going to worry about including that again today. It just would be redundant. But you can definitely peruse that on your own time online, looking at the slides, which are available on cs50.net. All right, so I'll now open the floor up to any and all questions. Ask me anything, essentially, pertaining to the course. Yes?
Document object model, is the only thing we have to know the get element by ID, or is there like more to it?
So we didn't go very in-depth. The question is, can we just know get elements by ID? Do we need to know anything else about the document object model? We didn't really cover the document object model very extensively this year. I believe that the only time we used the document object model, and I don't know that it was even ever mentioned by name in lecture, was using get element by ID. It's safe to say that you only need to know that about the document object model, so that should be sufficient. Any information I provide in addition to that is just to motivate what we mean when we're discussing it and was mostly something I thought was of interest. So don't worry too much about that structure. Yes? Oh, okay, great. So we have two birds and one stone. Two students had the same question. Anybody else? Any questions in preparation for the quiz? Okay, well, seeing none, looks like we're out of time and I'm out of content. So this being the last section of the year, well, this has been Section, guys. Thank you very much. It's been a really great semester. I've vastly enjoyed teaching this class, and I think I've learned a lot about being a teacher from teaching this section in addition to my other one, and it's been great having you guys here every week. So good luck on the quiz, and thank you so much for making this a great semester. Have a nice week, and good luck.